When Emma Forrest was a schoolgirl, she interviewed Nigella Lawson for her school magazine, and the celebrity TV cookbook writer was so impressed, she recommended the 13-year-old to the British newspaper The London Evening Standard. Emma's first article, a review of Madonna's Erotica album, appeared that year and helped launch her career as a music journalist, screenwriter, essayist and novelist. Since then, she's interviewed famous musicians and actors and travelled the world, and in 2009, Variety voted her one of the top 10 screenwriters to watch. Now in her early 30s and based in Los Angeles, Emma Forrest's third novel, Your Voice in My Head, tells a very different story of her life, a childhood with thoughts of suicide, of depression, of eating disorders and self-harm. It's also a story about Dr. R, the psychiatrist who saved her life, and her famous actor-lover, who she calls G.H., or Gypsy Husband. But as Emma Forrest explains to the book show's Anita Barrow, Your Voice in My Head is more than a memoir.
There are basically three love stories in this book. I think primarily the story is about me and the doctor who saved my life and changed my life when I was in the grips of terrible manic depression, and he turned my world around. But he had lung cancer and was dying and chose not to tell his patients because he was convinced he would get better and be fine. So it was a complete shock to us when he died. I couldn't get over it. I couldn't figure it out. I felt a sense of betrayal that I had no warning. But it is also a love story to my parents, who were there, you know, tearing their hair out, trying to get me back on track. And to the lover who ultimately challenged my equilibrium once, you know, things had been steady for a while. But, you know, I think where people are in their lives is how they interpret the book. In that sense, it's almost like song lyrics. It means what people want it to mean.
And we should say that the lover, G.H., Gypsy Husband, who you love and lose, is the Irish actor Colin Farrell, for those who are interested.
That's something that I keep hearing and being told. I've never said that myself, and I sort of prefer the idea for me that both he and the doctor, who were such pivotal figures, there was a reason I didn't name them. It was a time when, I don't know if you've ever found, I think this is fairly common, the idea that actual bereavement and romantic bereavement can really intertwine in a very strange way. And those two losses happened for me at the same time. And there was like a real psychological self-protection reason that not only did I not write down their actual names, but I also don't name them when I speak about it. The trouble, the difficulty and the challenge of being with the movie star was I had been healthy and well for many years, actually for good, I think, you know, 4 years without cutting at all and without any bulimia. And I was really at my peak of mental health when I met him. And that was the challenge in all these unnatural situations that I think would challenge anyone, especially someone with the predisposition towards these issues. So staying afloat through all of that, through being in the public eye and through being torn apart in the public eye, was all the proof I needed that I really am going to be okay in this world.
And I mean, you've rubbed shoulders with famous people of all kinds, Susan Sarandon and Brad Pitt. I mean, the book is actually peppered with names of the famous. Are they all true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, in the age of James Frey, they are so crazed about putting memoirs through 10 rounds of lawyers. So yes, everything is true. But you know, you also have to understand that's New York City as well. Is that's pretty much everyone's life daily is rubbing shoulders with these people. It's just, you don't even blink, you know, they're on the subway. That's why celebrities live in New York, is nobody cares.
And New York is really what triggered a lot of things for you.
It really did. And you know, I've been thinking about this lately, and I think New York is sort of a manic city. Is the city that never sleeps. Everyone is crazed in their own way, and living like that and being awake all the time and having so much to do, it just, I mean, my problem actually, when people talk about manic depression, they tend very often to talk about depression, but for me the problem was mania, was, you know, the danger of feeling like I was invincible and could do anything and could walk in front of traffic and it would have to stop. And yeah, that was really my downfall.
Well, let's talk about these sorts of manias, because you have quite a few descriptions. You describe bulimia, for example, as the wicked twin of orgasm.
Because it's unstoppable, and because of obviously the phallic nature of sticking your fingers down your throat, I think there is a reason that eating disorders are very often connected to sexual abuse, rape stories. In my case, I wasn't sexually abused, but my first sexual experiences, like for the first 5 years, I got really bad luck. And they were things that if you were 25 or 30 and had been having sex for a while, you could maybe make better sense of and be less affected by. But this was, you know, I was 16 and these things were shaping me, and I just started expressing it all on my body the way that women do. You know, men who are anxious or upset or fearful get into bar fights and do road rage, and women, we know, you know, at the safe end of the scale, they, you know, get their hair cut when they're going through something, or they dye their hair.
Or eat chocolate, ice cream, you're
cutting, you know, or bulimic or anorexic, and it's just all inward with women, is turning that anxiety and unhappiness in on yourself.
And cutting, you don't really have you describe mania as a river, you know, flowing, and suicide, the thoughts of suicide is very masculine. As, you know, Manhattan bearing down on me, you write, I walk home from Ghost Dog, you've just seen the movie, hand in hand with the thought of suicide. The thought of suicide is masculine energy with manicured nails like a mafioso. What's male about suicide?
Sweet talk. The way I was sweet, I feel like, you know, it was a voice that sweet talked me into something I didn't need to do. And for me, you know, I just started losing myself and not acting like myself. And I was very young, you know, when all this started happening.
It says in the book that you were about 12 when you were starting to be seduced by this idea of suicide.
Yeah. And, you know, you're 12 and you don't know if other children are thinking about this thing, and you're too afraid to ask them. So I just didn't know really until I got to New York that the thoughts I was having were not normal. And actually, you know, bipolar is generally triggered in adolescence, by adolescence, you know, by the hormonal change. It's rare that it happens at much of a later stage. But that's what was going on. I just didn't know it.
Oh, in actual fact, it says you're 13. I first thought of it at 13. We had a large bathroom with wall-to-wall mural of peacocks and birds of paradise. In fact, the bathroom was like everybody's kitchen. It was like a meeting place for the family. Which makes it very sad, because that's the place where you cut yourself also.
I've never thought of that, but I suppose the bathroom was a cocoon and a back to the womb sort of a situation. And a lot of it, I think, not just for me, for many girls, I would even venture for most girls, about cutting and bulimia, there is this big undercurrent of being sexualized before your time and wanting to stay a little girl. I mean, clearly with anorexia, you end up looking like a child, you know, in its extreme stages. And with cutting and bulimia is this childish idea of mess, of like, you know, just a toddler that gets food all over their face and can't control itself. I just wanted to be a little girl. I didn't want to be alone in New York. I love New York, but I didn't want to be alone there. I just wanted to curl up in my mother's arms, even though, you know, I was like 20.
I think, too, another sort of thing about the seduction, and it's especially for young women, it's a recurring theme throughout the book. It's the painting of Ophelia by the Pre-Raphaelite artist Millais. Now, there she is. She's floating down the stream in her heavy brocade dress surrounded by flowers. It's a common poster, and I had it in my bedroom, and I think my daughters did too. What is it about that painting, do you think?
she dies so beautifully. And when you've actually been there, you know, there is no beautiful way to die. It doesn't work like that. But it sure looks like that in the painting.
But you put yourself in the painting and you have her singing as she's floating down. And I think at one stage you have her singing Eyes on the Prize from Mavis Staples. I love that song.
Yeah.
And Velvet Underground too, I think.
I like these portals in and out of different periods, and I think very often with loneliness, when you feel a little lost in the world, sometimes you just put it down to, oh, I must be an anachronism, I was born in the wrong time. You know, that's a very teenage thing, was I always actually thought I should have been born in the 50s. You know, I should have been an ingenue, I should have been Elizabeth Taylor in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. It all would have been so much easier. But that's a very girl teen thing to, actually a feminine thing to identify with a certain period, I think.
And so how do you go about falling out of love with this sort of madness,
my gosh,
the Maid Muse?
You know what, part of it is growing up, and that was the skill of my doctor and of any great psychiatrist or therapist or counsellor, is keeping someone alive long enough to grow up. That is a big part of it. For me, it definitely was. And I think it takes courage, because it's easier to have the identity of I'm mad. So, you know, you can't judge me on any of my behaviour because it's out of my control. And taking the responsibility of transitioning into adulthood, when who doesn't want to stay a child? Who doesn't want to get permission to behave as badly as they want because they're ill? And I'm not saying it's that easy for people to, you know, snap out, because that would be too British, the idea of pull your socks up, you know, just get better and smile. And we know that's not true. For me, there was this leap of going, okay, I actually don't think cutting is such a great thing, because for a long time I couldn't even see what was wrong with it. Didn't know why people wanted me to stop.
And you say it takes courage, but I think they're interspersed in the book is some letters from other patients of Dr. R. A word that struck me was poise. A in New York writes, "I will carry Dr. R with me always. I will strive to emulate his kindness and poise, especially around those who are sick and suffering." I felt the word poise, it's like it does mean a state of balance, doesn't it?
Yeah. He's left me, because of this book, with the ability to communicate and touch other people who might be the sort of people he should have been helping. You know, I'm getting such amazing letters from all over the world. It's a lot of responsibility, because I am not a trained psychiatrist and I can only try and say what I would do in any situation. But I'm just getting this tapestry of pain that people overcame, and that everyone's story is so different and so unique, and yet, you know, sadness is sadness and pain is pain, and I just feel I don't believe in God, but I'll say I feel blessed by something or someone that people are opening up to me that way.
You don't believe in God, but you have a Jewish background.
Yeah.
And every time you say God, you do G-D.
Yeah, that's just superstition, really. You know, that's one of the things in Judaism that I think it's like, I have Catholic friends who don't believe in God either, but they're so used to and therefore comforted by the idea of ritual. And that's really what was applicable to me, was when I thought, oh my God, I might die from this, it was important to me to go to synagogue, because it meant I was singing songs that had been sung literally thousands of years earlier.
So it's about the ritual. It's about
it's about people who weren't supposed to survive. I mean, that's a constant story through the history of Judaism, is that you're meant to be wiped out over and over and over, and they survived.
Mm. I think one of the key moments of transformations is at the Shabbat, Dr. R's funeral, and the rabbi, in a very moving story, he says, "There's no one here who's lost so much they can't give."
Yeah. That is an amazing sermon. I made the rabbi laugh, because I love that sermon so much. I downloaded it onto my iPod and it ended up being between David Bowie and Debbie Harry, I think. but Yeah, you know, I'm someone who's had their lives saved a few times, I think, by music, you know, by music on headphones. And this specific rabbi, his name is David Wolpe, and his name is in the book. And he was voted, I believe, the number one rabbi in America. He's just such an amazing speaker. Acted for me like music, just this thing that helped me connect with myself. Because a lot of the problem with manic depression is just sort of floating away like a helium balloon and losing all sense of being earthed. And that's the gift of coming from a culture that has so much history.
It's being floating away, but it's also a very heightened sense of reality, of actually, you know, being feeling responsible for the world at one stage. You feel responsible. Well, you're sending off tapes to Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, because I thought I was the only person who could save him. And, you know, this is a constant discussion with artists and writers and musicians about manic depression is, of course, there's a big gift in it, is you do have these heightened senses. And I think that's why it's something people struggle with, how to, whether to medicate, whether not to medicate, how to deal with it, whether you even want it to go. Because it is certainly, I mean, I think Stephen Fry has talked a lot about this, is it's the mania that's given him the power to create so much over so many years.
But it's also the thing that can destroy that creativity too.
Oh, yeah.
That's the other side.
And I still don't know what the answer is, but I suppose, like anything, moderation and having the sense that things are within your control, that's rare, but a gift. I have been trying to write something like it for a while because my publishers in England, Bloomsbury, who I had published novels with from the age of, I think, 19, they knew that I had had a nervous breakdown and that I had been committed to a psychiatric hospital when I was, I was 22. They knew because I think I was late delivering a book, and I became very close to my editor there, and she said, you know, you should really think about this when you hit 30. You should write a memoir. You could really write your generation's Girl Interrupted. And I tried for a couple of years, and I just wasn't ready and I wasn't comfortable. And then when my doctor died so suddenly, it just started flowing because I needed to sift through all the work we had done, and I needed not to lose his voice in my head. I needed to internalize it. So that's why it suddenly, it came to fruition. It also was almost like a fever dream. I mean, I was writing and not even realizing I was writing. I was looking at my computer at the end of the day, and there was all this text that I didn't remember doing.
So it was a real stream of consciousness, really.
Yeah, the first draft certainly, and then because I have a background in journalism, it's been a really useful tool because I'm very big on editing. I think some writers are a little precious or a little afraid about, you know, cutting words, and part of journalism is being very unsentimental about that.
And the words are very lyrical. I mean, you talk about songs and lyrics being something that you respond very much to, but the writing is also has that element to it.
I've always leaned on my favourite singer-songwriters when I'm writing. I've always gone back to Leonard Cohen and Paul Simon and, you know, Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, rather than reading other novelists when I'm writing. Can I tell you just from my head my favourite Paul Simon lyric?
Yep.
There's a girl in New York City, she calls herself the human trampoline. Sometimes when I'm falling, flying, tumbling in turmoil, I say, whoa, so this is what she means. So that's something I related to a lot.
She means we're bouncing into Graceland, and I see losing love is like a window in your heart.
Paul Simon's Graceland, ending Anita Barra's interview with Emma Forrest. Emma Forrest's memoir is called Your Voice in My Head. It's published by Bloomsbury, and she'll be appearing at this month's Sydney Writers' Festival.